From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Central and South America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. So, Tony, welcome back. A pleasure as always.
Yeah, thanks, Don. It's good to be back talking to you, and we're a bit late with this program, aren't we?
Yes, we are, but that's okay because something is always happening in that region, so let's hit it.
Yeah, the main things that are going on at the moment, the continuing process in Venezuela, of course. The presidential elections in Chile on Sunday, then a week later, presidential elections and elections for the Legislative Assembly in Honduras. Also, some mixed developments in Colombia.
Yeah.
Where the violence against social leaders continues. The day before yesterday, I think it was the 120th community leader, social leader, was murdered this year in Colombia.
Right.
So, something that I want to focus on, maybe we should talk about the Chilean election first.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's do that. But I want to make sure we talk about Venezuela and Russia and some other things around that.
Go ahead. I think talking about Chile will lead us naturally into talking about Venezuela and also Nicaragua, because there's something to note about Nicaragua in relation to Venezuela now.
Right.
The presidential election on Sunday in Chile looks likely to be, it could be a three-horse race, depending on turnout. The Chilean elections over the last 10 years or so, or even longer, have been characterized by low turnout. So it's typical there for there to be a turnout of around 40%, even in a presidential election. Now, the three main forces are Chile Vamos under former President Sebastián Piñera, who's a right-winger neoliberal, totally committed to the United States agenda in Latin America and the region. His main rival is a guy called Alejandro Guillier, who represents, I think it's called Nueva Mayoría, is his party, and that's a coalition of political parties basically aligned with the policies of the current government under Michelle Bachelet. But Michelle Bachelet's been quite unpopular because she hasn't been able to deliver the economic goods in terms of an economic recovery following the drop in commodity prices that has affected all of Latin America.
Yeah.
And the third candidate is a woman called Beatriz Sanchez of the Frente Amplio, which is another attempt by the Chilean left and progressive parties to mount a serious challenge that will give them a significant political representation in Chile that may be able to affect policy. Now, the main issues in the election are the economy, employment, the usual, but also there are two key issues that there's a lot of controversy about in Chile. One is the pension fund administrating organizations, which are basically exploiting the Chilean economically active people in Chile who are part of the pension system there, because they don't give the benefits that the people really need to enjoy a dignified old age. So that's a big issue in Chile. And the other big issue is education, and because there's a huge movement for free. I'm not sure if secondary education in Chile is free or not, but education is a big issue, and access to university is a big issue. So those two issues will figure in the election, but the key issue is the economy, of course. And so as I think we mentioned before in previous programs, it looked as though Piñera was going to walk it about a month ago.
Mm.
And the polls still give him a good advantage.
Yeah, 24%. Sanchez doesn't show at all in the polls. Why is that?
Well, because That's a good question.
I mean, not even zero. It's just blank. It's as if she wasn't on the list.
Her own polling, her friend Ampliu's polling, if you read their spokespeople, they say that they're within striking distance of Guillet.
Right.
And so much depends on turnout. A low turnout favours the right wing and the current government.
Right.
And doesn't favour the progressives and the radicals. A high turnout could mean that Beatriz Sanchez does better than expected.
Right.
And the likely result is that Piñera will win, but not with a sufficient majority to avoid a second round.
Right.
Guillier will come second, so they'll probably go into the runoff. And then it's by no means certain that Piñera will win.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at another poll. This is Cadem. Shows Piñero at 42%, Guillier at 20%, and Sanchez at 13%. And so if you end up with Sanchez maybe, you know, outperforming the poll and ending up second, you could have Piñera and Sanchez. Or if Piñera is overinflated because he's the darling of the, you know, polling companies and media people, then who knows? He might have a close one three ways.
Yeah, and so much depends on the turnout. And that was a key factor in the Venezuelan regional elections that surprised everybody.
Yeah.
But the only people who were surprised were people who weren't really paying attention.
Right.
And so who knows what the eventual outcome on Sunday will be, but it's likely to be a runoff between Piñera and Guillermo. If there's a high turnout, Beatriz Sanchez stands a chance, but it's an outside chance.
Right.
So then if you look at that, whoever wins that election, the United States and the regional right wing will hail them as the democratically elected authorities of Chile.
Right.
There'll be no question about it.
Right.
Even on a 40% turnout, even if they only get into office or with, say, 22-23% of the total electorate,
that's right,
they'll still be hailed as champions of electoral democracy, right? Now, if you compare that with the reaction to the Venezuelan elections, the regional elections, there was a turnout there of, what was it, 54%? Something like that?
Yeah, more than that. Yeah, it was just shy of 60, if I remember correctly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so it was a good turnout, well over 50%, but there, the right wing and the international corporate media, the regional right wing and the international corporate media, challenged that and said, "Oh well, it's all fake."
Right, that's right.
So and the double standard is absolutely clear, and it's becoming clearer and clearer as time goes by, and also clearer and clearer as time goes by is the fact that what we're dealing with here in Latin America and all over the world, but we see it especially clearly here in Latin America, is that there's a choice between the evil neoliberal policies of a tiny elite against the positive policies based on development, focused on the human person, that are promoted by the governments of Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, and all the progressive movements that are members of the, for example, of the regional Foro Sao Paulo, which is the regional grouping of progressive political movements throughout the continent. And that, so all this nonsense about pink tides, about conservative restoration, we have to keep insisting.
I know.
We're talking about two fundamental visions. One is evil and one is good.
One is, I won't even add a moral dimension to it. In front of a voter, this one is going to steal your wallet and that one wants to take you out to dinner.
Sure.
Okay.
I tend to emphasize the moral dimension because
I hear you.
If you look at what's happening in Venezuela, and it is utter nonsense for U.S. spokespeople at any level to talk about their concern for the Venezuelan people, you know, their concern for the democracy or liberty and all the rest of that absolute claptrap.
Yep.
Absolutely. No, and we. Sure, yeah. I think we can't be too emphatic in insisting on this, because I read a report yesterday in Hispan TV. I hope it's wrong. The Venezuelan opposition politicians had a meeting with Trump White House officials, President Trump's officials in the White House, in which they called for sanctions against Nicaragua. Now, Nicaragua is already the victim of this ridiculous piece of legislation, the Nicaragua Investment Conditionality Act.
Right, the NICA.
But now it looks as though they're going to go after Nicaragua mainly because Nicaragua is one of the countries in the OAS and one of the more vulnerable countries in the OAS, along with the Caribbean island nations, that have been stymieing and blocking the attempts by the White House puppet Secretary General of the Organization of American States, Luis Almagro, to push through a vote enabling the Organization of American States to apply the so-called Inter-American Charter, the Democratic Charter, against Venezuela.
Right.
Now this is if you look at that again, Nicaragua just had municipal elections in which the governing Frente Sandinista political party, the Sandinista Front, won 68% of the popular vote. They won 135 of the country's 153 municipalities. Daniel Ortega has approval levels as president of 80%. But even so, the nonsense coming, the unmitigated nonsense that's coming out of the White House is that Nicaragua is somehow anti-democratic.
Well, look, I mean, here's the flip side of this. There's a dialectic involved here. What they're doing to Venezuela right now ends up leaving a condition where you have Russia and China making an alliance with, in essence, an economic alliance with Venezuela. Restructuring $3.15 billion of debt from Venezuela to Russia, for example. They now can make minimal payments over the next 6 years. And China's foreign ministry issues statements bolstering, the creds, basically, of Venezuela's economic condition in the international markets, with respect to debt. So, if the United States wants to alienate Nicaragua and a bunch of other places, the U.S. turning its attention to Nicaragua means the canal's going to get built that much more quickly. Watch what happens. Mark my word on that.
Yeah, we'll see. I've always felt, whereas a lot of people say, oh, well, the canal isn't going to happen because it's financially not viable or not viable for one or other reason. Yeah. I think the main reason that's holding up the canal is precisely the fact that China doesn't want to invest whatever it is, $50 billion in the canal over the next 5 to 10 years, because why should they make that investment in a geopolitical area where they cannot defend that investment militarily?
Right. Well,
so that to me is the main thing that's stopping go ahead for the canal.
Russia's been talking about out loud, expanding its military presence in Cuba, and if they're throwing $3.15 billion up in the air for another 10 years with Venezuela, then what you're talking about. And by the way, relationship between Russia and Venezuela has huge implications for global oil markets.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And with China, too.
Right.
And China's developing its refining capacity to take more Venezuelan heavy crude.
Right.
As you say, these have very serious implications for international politics at a global level.
Yep, that's right. Absolutely true.
And looking, as you say, the crucial thing now in Venezuela is the Venezuelan government has defeated the United States and the U.S. regional allies' efforts to bring the governments to its knees via a kind of the paramilitary style or pseudo paramilitary style violence that was that they tried to foment. From between April and July, they failed. The Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have set up the National Constituent Assembly, which was a huge democratic triumph in genuine democratic terms for the Venezuelan people,
yep.
and a massive setback for Venezuela's opposition, especially the more extreme parts of Venezuela's opposition.
Yeah.
And you can see that in the way that the Venezuelan opposition is in effect breaking up. So what you've had since the establishment of the National Constituent Assembly and since the very successful regional elections from the point of view of the governing United Socialist Party of Venezuela, is a breakup of the political opposition. They're in crisis, and the cavalry that have come to their rescue are Donald Trump sanctions, new sanctions, specifically designed to make it impossible for Venezuela to operate in Western financial markets. Now the European Union have come up with some sanctions that are in large part irrelevant. You know, for example, putting a boycott on armaments to Venezuela, as if Venezuela would be interested in European armaments, you know, when they've got some superb world-class armaments available from Russia that have just demonstrated their superiority in Syria.
Right, that's right.
At the moment, the EU sanctions are pretty much symbolic, a kind of a gesture, a wave towards the United States saying, oh, we're with you. But not really making a significant difference to Venezuela's overall position. Now, if the European Union then move to implement financial sanctions, then that is much more serious. And that will, who knows how that'll pan out. But even without that, it seems absolutely clear that, as you said earlier, Venezuela is now more closely aligned than ever it was with Russia and with China, and that very, very clearly the United States is kind of throwing all it's got, including threats of military intervention, including holding military exercises just a couple of hundred kilometers from Venezuela's border, there in northern Amazonia, Brazil's northwestern Amazonia. And those military exercises are being held with, together with the military forces of Colombia, Peru, and Brazil, with something like 22 other countries observing. You know, so yep. It's very clear that in all senses, the United States is gearing up at a level still somewhat below the level of threat, obviously, that they're applying to North Korea, but it's still a very serious level of threat, includes a military dimension. And so what will happen, the question is, what will the United States do? What will its government do? What will its allies do when, as is almost inevitable, their financial sanctions also fail?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. You know, there's a variety of models that they employ. Let's, be clear on that. But they have all failed. The military is loyal to the government, for example. So you can't have a general announcing on television, as happened in Zimbabwe yesterday, that, oh, no, there's no coup. I'm just doing the news tonight in uniform. You know, that fails. There's loyalty. Chavez took care of that problem when he was president, and that condition remains. The opposition is splintered, as we've been discussing for a couple years now. They're, you know, the exercise in futility evident over the last two plebiscites, if you could call the one that they conducted a plebiscite, crash a helicopter against the Constitutional Court, because we really don't have any other way of, demonstrating our power here. The government has managed to deal with and expose the economic warfare that's been conducted against the people of Venezuela, in essence, and against Venezuela's economy by the opposition in conjunction with the U.S. and the EU. And that apparently is becoming known to the people, both as evidenced by the turnaround at the ballot box that we've seen over the last two elections, really.
Yeah.
And also we've got a condition where the international players. I mean, we've discussed, and it's, you know, clear to people that are observers, Venezuela was kind of pivotal in the global picture in terms of the rise of multipolarity. It's been at the center of the rise of, Bolivarian-type independence for the region from the United States, and that in turn, with Brazil at the head, makes it a pivotal spot for multipolarity as expressed in the BRICS. And so with all of that, we see, China and Russia saying, hey, guess what? Yeah, they are important. We're going to, do some things with them. And, they're not alone. Cuba had to stand alone after the collapse, after the Soviet Union was dismantled for a couple of decades. Venezuela is not alone. China and Russia are there now. Whether they'll fight a world war to defend Venezuela, probably not. They are certainly throwing, when you start throwing billions of dollars into somebody's pocket to try to keep them from starving, you're going to hang with them for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And even at a regional level, Venezuela is far from alone. Right. And the Caribbean island nations have been key in protecting Venezuela inside the OAS.
And Bolivia's hanging tough, and Nicaragua too.
Yeah, and it seems to me to be a sign of United States government desperation that they're talking about intensifying sanctions against Nicaragua. Nicaragua's a tiny country of 6 million people, maybe 6.5 million people, right? Why should they care about Nicaragua? Only because Nicaragua and its and Venezuela's other allies in the Organization of American States have made Luis Almagro look stupid.
Yep.
And so we'll see what happens about that. And another key thing, of course, in the Venezuelan situation is what's happening in Colombia. As we said earlier, that the murders of community and social activists in Colombia, they're well over 100 now. 120 people, community activists, social activists, have been murdered in Colombia this year. And yet even so, it's Venezuela that is supposed to be the failed state. If you look at Colombia, they've still got those millions of displaced people from their 50-year civil war, 60-year civil war, and the peace process, which was it created such great hope, both within Colombia and across the region. The peace process has been hobbled. And very seriously damaged in many ways, not because Juan Manuel Santos himself, the president of Colombia, has not had the will to move it forward, but the configuration of political forces since the signing of the agreement has meant that the judicial implementation and the legislative implementation that the government should have been able to drive forward much more forcefully than it has have stalled. Now, there was a positive development last week, or maybe it was just over the weekend, when the Supreme Court approved the special jurisdiction of peace, which is one of the key elements of the Colombian peace agreement, and which gives people the opportunity, gives victims of the conflict the opportunity of getting justice. And both sides, both the government, which in theory represents the armed forces, though you could argue strongly about that, that both the government, as the representative of the armed forces who are responsible for so many human rights abuses, atrocities, and massacres over the years, and the FARC, who have their own unhappy record of abuses, will be held to account within a special framework that everybody agrees on, that even the FARC have agreed on as part of the peace process.
Right.
Now, that's unique. And I don't think that's ever happened in any process of conflict resolution, certainly over the last, you know, in modern times.
Yeah, not that I'm aware of, for sure.
So it's really important that the Supreme Court approved that. But there are other things that it hasn't, and that in that judgment also should facilitate the participation of the new political party that's also called the FARC. It's got the Alternative Revolutionary Forces of the Commons is kind of a rough English translation. Mm-hmm. But when recently political representatives of the FARC tried to engage in perfectly normal activity in the National Assembly, they were barred from entry by the president of the National Assembly, in complete contradiction to the spirit, certainly, and perhaps even the letter of the peace agreement. But what's happening is that because Juan Manuel Santos has lost authority, he's caught up in his own corruption scandal, apparently to do with the Brazilian engineering construction company Odebrecht. Mm. He's caught up in that scandal, so that's affected his authority. But also his authority has been affected by, for example, his former vice president, is now running as a candidate for the elections in, well, I think it's May 2018, next year. What's that? It's barely 6 months away, not even 6 months away. And so that too, that now that the political life in Colombia is geared to electoral campaign mode, and that is affecting the implementation of the legislative components of the peace agreement. And that is holding up the ability of the FARC's political representatives to take part in normal political life in Colombia, which they should have been able to do by now. And so, why is that happening? It's partly because Santos has lost authority, but also because Álvaro Uribe, the former president, and his colleagues, the right-wing colleagues, extreme right-wing colleagues, most of whom are deeply identified with the narco-terror paramilitary groups that are filling the vacuum now that has been left in the areas where the FARC has disarmed. Uribe and his team have been very astute in building alliances and taking advantage of what was really, from my point of view, and I regarded that there was a referendum on the peace process in Colombia, but it took place in circumstances that were far from ideal. I mean, there was a natural disaster caused by extreme flooding in an area that prevented hundreds of thousands of people from voting.
Yeah, definitely suppressed turnout, definitely.
Yeah, and also you can bet your life that there was a rigging of the vote. So
the people where the voting was suppressed, you're talking about places that were flooded, that, you know, the roads were not the highest, you know, value, you know, all, in other words, the people most likely to need a peace process were the ones whose vote was suppressed by that.
Yeah, very clearly. So but even despite that, the no vote won just by a whisker, but with that victory, that Uribe and his cronies are able to create political capital and encourage that gives a basis for their bureaucrats in the legislative administrative system and their judges, their bought off judges in the judicial system,
right,
to hold up the implementation of the peace process,
yep.
It'll be very interesting and crucial for the peaceful development of that part of the Latin America,
yep.
And in particular for Venezuela in the current context.
Which it borders, and we'll have to come back to that next week because we are completely out of time. But yeah, it's key. It's a positive trend, and thank you for being with us, Tony. It's a pleasure as always.
Okay, thanks a million, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.